Call the meeting back to order, please.
Sure got rid of the problem. You get rid of a ton of paper, too.
Okay, the next item on our agenda under council action items is going to be ordinance 17-2900, zoning text amendment to Title 17-Code Scrub.
Council, this item is something that, of course, has also been through Planning Commission, because like the item we just discussed, this is a legislative item, so it's been there for a Planning Commission review and public hearing. A code scrub, as we call it, is a series of relatively minor changes. Oftentimes, they are primarily technical changes, corrections where a cross-reference is missed during another code amendment or things like that. But also, typically, we will find small things that aren't worth processing individually, and we package them together, because this does require an application that goes through a SEPA review, which requires notice in the newspaper, and then there's public hearing notice in the newspaper. So processing one of these costs the city in hard cash about $700 for notice requirements, but it also includes staff time. So we bundle these intentionally. This one was initiated by staff. It's a series of various items. We did have one thing added in by a private citizen who said, we're interested in doing this, and we said, well, the code doesn't allow you to do that, and they said, is there a way to change it? And I said, you're in luck, because we're doing this kind of thing right now. As a result of some discussions with council about a memo we brought forward related to conditional use process, we've brought in some things in this that are from sort of council requests. Didn't go through the resolution process with council, but we were already processing a bunch of items, and when we went to Planning Commission, they said, yeah, go ahead and make those changes as well. So as I said, public notice was processed, and a SEPA, which is the State Environmental Policy Act, environmental review was processed, and notice of a determination of non-significance was issued, meaning there are no significant adverse environmental effects expected from this code amendment, primarily because these things still get reviewed during the development process, and any of the changes in here would go through another review. So to summarize the multiple different actions, oh, by the way, one item is, this is one of the things that was on the table when you walked in. We put a revised or a new copy of an ordinance that is in color. This accidentally got reformatted by the printer into some very odd font style. Might have been really hard to read, and it wasn't in color. So there is a brand new ordinance. Language is exactly the same, but it's in color. And I know if you're like me, by now you have about 10 things scattered on your table. Mm-hmm. If you're lucky enough to be able to find it, it's there. Okay. So this will adjust the planned unit development code for the density in the planned residential zoning district. When we were creating the PUD code, we were also reviewing a density increase in the Semiahmoo uplands to go from 3 dwelling units to 4 dwelling units. That got put into the PUD code as sort of the starting point for density, but that did not get approved in the other code amendment. So there's a conflict there. We want to bring the PUD code density table in alignment with what is actually approved in the PR zoning district. Residential design standards are written in a way now that they basically require a 712 roof pitch no matter what the pitch is of your existing roof. So if you're doing an addition, it puts us in an awkward position of telling you either to do something that looks horrible, or we do an administrative interpretation and say, yes, that's what they really meant, was to make your house look good and continue the 412 roof pitch that's on the rest of your home, that kind of thing. So that's adjusted to basically say you can match your existing roof pitch, and in fact, new accessory structures on your property should also look like the primary structure and not be dramatically different as driven by the design standards. That doesn't take the design standards away, though. A new home would be required to build at the higher roof pitch and be of that more traditional design. The thing is, we have a lot of homes that were built in the 60s and 70s that you just can't match in that way. manufacturing design standards, there's a an amendment there as well, and it's actually not manufacturing design standards, it's the manufacturing performance standards, excuse me, which is a review process of nuisances, and that just needed some cleaning up to tell who was responsible for those actions. Junk vehicles is proposed to be deleted from the Title 17 section because it is included in the nuisance code section with the official state definition of junk vehicles. So now we have a conflict there, so we want to get it out of Title 17, so we're only defining it once.
And that's junk vehicles in any zone.
Junk vehicles in any zone, right. Well, actually, in Title 17, it talks about them just in the residential zone, but in the other section, it's junk vehicles anywhere, any zone, and it defines them specific to the state law.
That was going to be one of my questions. I thought that was the answer.
Yes.
Okay.
So the food service section, this is the item that we were asked to include. We were asked to include it by Alan Finston, who is the recent purchaser of the Bank of America. And I will explain that a little bit more when we go on, but it's to allow food service in the specific area there. Hardship extension, way back during the recession, there was a proposal by the public to create a longer time period. Basically, nothing expired for a longer period of time, and that was all date dependent. It said that projects approved before such and such date shall be, you know, eligible for a automatic one-year extension until such and such date. All those dates have passed, so it's just taking up room in the code. It means nothing anymore. We clarified the vesting of applications with some help from John Sitkin, our city attorney, to be more specific about when something is vested, who makes the decision, and kind of how that all plays out. It's technical change. And then right now we have a conflict in our accessible parking spaces in our parking code are described in a way that is inconsistent with the Americans with Disabilities Act, and what we want to do is make it consistent with that by saying as in the International Building Code, which really dictates those things anyway. So the item related to food service has to do with some of our rezoning of the downtown area. We clarified some things. We created the Garden District, which is sort of on the fringe area. We're actually standing in that. I'm standing in that now. And then the Market District, Waterview District, and we have a district called the Town Portal, which is the area. My slide's not projecting as I expected it to, but the area that's kind of the brightest red up there with the sort of pinkish border around it looks like a wedge sort of towards the freeway, and that is that area was the area in downtown that we added apartment buildings without ground floor commercial to. So basically it became like a high density pocket. Now you can still do a lot of commercial uses in that area, but when the Planning Commission was putting that together, they were very sensitive to the idea of, do people really want to live with some of these other uses nearby? And the decision at that time by the commission and then supported by the council was to take food and beverage facilities, eating and drinking establishments, out of that little pocket. And the library is in that pocket, the skate park is in that pocket, the old Bank of America building is, the physical therapy office, and then some of those other vacant properties are in that same area. And so Mr. Finston, being the new owner of the Bank of America building, wanting to open up a facility that would be food and beverage sales, and wanting to sometimes do that in conjunction with on-site food trucks to have like a little bit of a festival environment, we had to tell him that's not consistent with the zone. You either have to change the zoning code or you have to rezone your property, and this was how it ended up in here. You'll see from your packet, there was a tremendous outpouring of comment, like almost unilaterally in support. There were a couple of comments in opposition. One was related to not allowing food trucks at all, and another one was related to they were only supportive if the person wasn't going to sell wine to go, because they have a wine to go store. So generally, though, it was very much in support, and the commission recommends that we make that change and turn those two things, food trucks and eating and drinking establishments in that area, like in all the rest of downtown except the transition, what used to be the transition district is the Garden District now, make them permitted uses. Then the other items were related to conditional uses that we're regulating not by use, really, but by size. So in the residential high-density zoning district, we have multifamily is permitted, and multifamily up to a certain density is permitted, but then a higher density requires a conditional use permit. In the residential medium density zoning district, the number of units is regulated, where a triplex, a fourplex, those are just permitted by right, a fiveplex or a sixplex requires a conditional use permit. So it's not the use that's different, it's multifamily, it's how many of the units are in one building or how many are on an acre. Those things are all related, are also all regulated by open area requirements, which is kind of like a landscaping requirement, setbacks, height limits, parking standards. So they already have all those other rules. And staff's recommendation was, if multifamily is okay, it's okay. And a fourplex could be a much bigger building than a sixplex, depending upon how big the rooms are and how big the bedrooms are or how many bedrooms you have. And so it really comes down to, that didn't make a whole lot of sense. Commission agreed with that and recommends that those become permitted uses. If that use is a permitted use, in some instances, why is it not permitted in others? And the exact same thing was the discussion point in the residential office zoning district, where offices up to 1,000 square feet are permitted by right, but an office that's 1,001 square feet or larger is a conditional use. And the same thing applied there. It's like, well, if it's a dentist office with 1,000 square feet and that's okay, why is a dentist office with 1,050 square feet or 2,000 square feet or 3,000 square feet not okay? An office is an office is an office, and it still has to provide parking, meet the height limits, and all those other things. And in the same instance, they said, yeah, the use isn't really the issue here because we've already said the use is okay. We should eliminate that hurdle. But some of the other things still apply in that particular instance, like it being being compatible with the neighborhood and providing a limited impact on the neighborhood. So we would still do things like require access from the side street or those sorts of things, depending upon the specific site.
Mike, I have a question. Would an office building be allowed then?
Like an office building in the residential office?
A building, maybe 2-3 stories, which is nothing but offices. Would that be allowed in the RO zone?
Right now, it would be permitted if it were only 1,000 square feet, and if it were 2,000 square feet, it would need a conditional use permit.
Per
but yes, it would be total size of offices.
Okay.
In
so
the
now
building.
under this, it would be allowed.
It would be allowed. So like a 3,000 square foot office building would be allowed.
Right.
And when you mentioned things like heights and whatnot, it would be allowed whatever the height limit is. So with the same height limit for a house would be the height limit for the office.
Yeah. And you could even combine them, offices on the ground floor and
Residential up above. You could, yeah, that mixed use
that
would be permitted.
Both be allowed.
Right, okay. Yeah. So the key is it doesn't change any of the bulk or design standards.
Yeah.
It just says if that use is permitted under certain sizes, it's permitted under larger sizes
right.
Also.
Okay.
I don't think we're going to see a lot of this used in any case, to be quite honest with you, any of these three, but it simplifies things.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so the Planning Commission recommends approval of Ordinance 17-2900, which is the ordinance crafted with all of these changes, that included all the changes originally proposed to the Planning Commission in that motion, in that application.
Question? Michael, on the RO zone, it says in order to get multifamily dwellings, you have to get a conditional use permit.
That's correct.
And yet it says over for the residential high density, you can get this, it's permitted.
That's correct, because there are two different zoning districts. Residential high-density zoning district is the description of that zone. The purpose statement is essentially for apartments. In the residential office, the purpose statement is something different. And so residences and offices are permitted, single-family residences, I should say, and offices are permitted. Multifamily is conditionally permitted.
But as far as the offices, I was always of the impression that the offices would be permitted on the bottom floor, and then residential would be required above.
That's not how the code is written, sir.
So there's no requirement for someone coming in and saying, well, I'm going to build this multi-family units. I don't have to put in any office space.
In the residential office zoning district, that's correct. But they need a conditional use permit to build multifamily.
Okay.
There's no connection between office and the residential on a project site. That's not required.
I guess I have one other concern about the whole thing. When we were going through with the GMA, one of the big pushes was for increased density. Have we done that?
Have we increased density? Well, not since we adopted the comp plan, no. The increase, and I guess I should ask you, do you mean has the real density on the ground increased or has the planned density increased?
I see that the Exhibit A, it's talking about going for the our planned residential, I guess it's recreational. We've taken it from 3 to 4, or have we taken it from 4 to 3?
In the RPR, the Residential Planned Recreation Zoning District, there was a proposal when we were going through our comprehensive planning process to change that from 3 to 4, and that was denied here at Council. We did pass something just like that for the planned residential zoning district, which is essentially East Blaine, and we went from and we required a minimum of 4 dwelling units per acre out there. And so on paper, we've taken numerous steps to increase our density. Real density won't change substantially, except for over a fair amount of time. It will take 5 or 10 or so years because we have a base of so many units at a certain density. It takes a long time to affect a change of that.
I'm trying to remember why we went from 3 to 4 to 3.
Well, it was always 3 in Semiahmoo. Yeah. And that was the issue, was that that's a lower density than GMA encourages. But it was determined at Council that that was what the long-term vision and plan was for such a long time there, that it was appropriate to stay with the 3 dwelling units per acre.
I guess the argument would then be, why wouldn't that also hold for any zone?
Well, because we don't have long-term, for one, that's a lot less dense than some of our zones, so that would be a big change, a big departure from what we're doing. And also because we don't have a long-term 30-year-old master plan for those other zones would probably be the biggest reason.
But they've been there for that long.
Yeah, they've been there for longer than that in many instances. But most of the areas that are older neighborhoods are at a density greater than 3 dwelling units per acre. So unless you have any other questions, that's all I have.
Staff recommends.
I have one other question. There was a statement in here about, I got to find it, on performance standards clarification, and there's down in E. That's talks about.
What page are you on, Ben?
1, 2, back page of 3, under E. Never having read this before, in the old plans, it kind of jumped out at me that we've got a committee now of 5 people, and 3 of them are council members.
Yes. That's how it's written today.
And what is their role? What's the?
Their role is to review potential nuisances in the manufacturing zoning district. when they may be a conflict or in violation of performance standards. And so it would be an ad hoc committee, which in the 9.5 years I've been here has never been formed or used once.
That's what I was worried about.
Well, we haven't had a need to use it. It would be in an instance where we have the adequate number of complaints against a property to take a subjective issue like noise, or not even noise, because that's very objective. You can use a sonometer, I think it's called. Say somebody complains about odor and they think it's a bad smell, and then we would bring to consideration. That's subjective. Some people might like the smell, or some people might not smell it, or might not find it to be so strong it's objectionable. And then that's when this committee would be formed to try and evaluate. And it's a committee of people from the offending party, the potentially offending party, people from the offended party, and planning commissioner and city council members to make an assessment of, is it in fact a problem? And then they, if they determine it is a problem, they report that to me, and then the director handles enforcement against them. It's literally, it's so poorly worded today that it wouldn't be good to go to court based on what this says today. We're just proposing to change it, and I would expect in the next 5 or 10 years we probably won't have to use it either.
That's okay.
My planning commissioner said, can we really draft the city council members into work on this committee? And I said, well, yeah, if they approve this. So,
let's take that out. Okay, I don't have those sheets right now. So we've got staff concurs with the planning commission. Recommendation of approval encourages the city council to approve ordinance 17-2900, adopting amendments to the municipal code by revising Title 17 to make changes to permitted uses, to delete outdated text, to clarify vesting of applications, and to revise certain review processes.
So move.
Okay.
Second.
Made and second. Are there further questions or comments? Hearing none, I'll call for the vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed say nay. Hearing none, the motion is carried 6-0. Okay, next on the agenda is the Port of Bellingham Small City Economic Development Grant application.
I'm almost done for a little while, and then you'll have a brief intermission to listen to Raven. and this will be quick. The item here is, as the mayor said, Small Cities Economic Development Fund. Staff has put together an application to the Port of Bellingham for their, it's not really a grant program, but every year they award money to the small cities that's already predetermined to go to the various small cities. While it's not strictly required, it is sort of tradition, if you will, to always have a one-to-one match or better. It's always a challenge for us to plan in advance of what these very small projects would be, because they are very small projects. This year they're not awarding the typical of $20,000, they're awarding a maximum of $15,000. And what we put together was a proposal to survey and then prepare plans, construction plans, grading plans, for the easement that's on the Burlington Northern Railroad tracks, that's behind the properties on the west side of Peace Portal Drive. It sort of functions like an alley. The little gravel lane that's down there now, which many of you have probably driven on, for the most part is not on the easement. It's just sort of come into existence by people driving along down there. And what we want to do is find out, well, for one, where is the easement? It's 20 feet wide. And then design what would be like a gravel lane or maybe a paved lane on that, which would be very beneficial to any properties that want to develop there. We're not proposing to construct anything. In fact, this money can't go towards construction. It can only go towards planning and design. We have one support letter from a property owner along that corridor who is actually looking at renovating the old Hollinger building at this point, and he owns another larger piece of property that Mr. Lawrenson is very familiar with. a little further south that he's looking at some point in the future for doing some development. And so we're hoping that this will meet the port's requirements and it will be something that they will provide us with $15,000 for. The kicker for that is I need to ask you to commit up to $15,000 of funds, and we propose the Rural Economic Development Fund to match if this is awarded by the port. And that's really what this request is for.
Michael, that doesn't go beyond F Street, that easement?
No, not to the north. It stops at F Street to the north, I believe.
The easement stops?
The easement stops at F Street, and then it heads south is where it goes, south of F Street.
And then how far south does it go?
It goes to Chattatai, but we're not proposing to survey or design that whole segment, for one, because that would cost more than $30,000, so it's too big, but also because when you get down by the parking lot by the caboose, the easement is on the side of a steep hill. So if someone's going to build something there, they're actually going to excavate away and change the grade. So it doesn't make any sense to design something, because you'd have to design in a big retaining wall and things like that. That would ultimately not get built. So we're proposing to stop H for financial reasons, but also practically it doesn't make any sense to try and go further until there's a project. And we do think this has a real economic stimulus possibility, because we literally have projects, folks that are looking at some of those properties either for purchase or have recently purchased and are in the design phase for one building in particular.
Do you know how much is left in the red fund?
It's about $300,000. I don't know off the top of my head.
That sounds about right, $300,000.
Further questions? Okay, staff recommends council authorize staff to submit the request for small city economic development funds to the Port of Bellingham, supported by a commitment of up to $15,000 from the Rural Economic Development Fund.
So move.
Second.
Okay, motion has been made and seconded. Any further questions or comments? Hearing none, I'll call for the vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say nay. Motion is carried 6-0. Okay, the next item on our agenda is department reports. The first item is public works and project updates.
I think I'm giving Mr. Jones a little breather, it sounds like. So that's great. Obviously, or maybe not so obviously, but a lot of my time has been getting ready for the TBD and all of its various functions. I have done several presentations in and around the city, and have several more going as a public education piece, both with city staff. I have three set up for next Wednesday, a week from this coming Wednesday, the 22nd. The school board on the 27th, so I will either have Mr. Bullock here, or I don't know if it's the same day as this council meeting. We'll figure that out. The chamber and the Semiamu board in March, as well as the Semiamu men's breakfast in March. And then last week I presented both at the Park and Cemetery Board and at Planning Commission. So I think that all of those have really helped to bring the message to you all. So I want to thank you for your leadership today in voting for that resolution. And we'll see what we can do about being successful in April. At our PRAC meeting, we've been working on street vacation policy and downtown street guidelines. Our next meeting is the 2nd of March, so a week or 2 weeks from this Thursday. And then just a couple of bid notes. Lincoln Park Sewer is bid opening will be next week, and the Vista Terrace Electric is going out next week. I had hoped to bid them together, but we had a little delay with the consulting engineer for the Vista Terrace project that's been worked out. So that's all I have, unless there's questions.
Questions for Raven. Hearing none. Thank you, Raven. Community Development Services.
Okay. This is really, really good news, and I'm not going to rush through it, even though it's a little bit late, if you'll bear with me, because this is a year that we see a really big increase in development activity, which is something that we've been hoping for a pretty long time. So this is our 2016 year-end development report. There were 72 total residential units added or permitted last year. That is up from 30 the year before and 16 the year before that. So it was essentially a doubling from 2014 to 2015, and then more than a doubling from 2015 to 2016. It's a good thing. And that 72 units is starting to put us a little bit closer to the kind of development activity we were seeing around the housing boom, which does make me a little scared. I'm just hoping we don't have another, housing boom and then follow after that. But 72 units is a good, healthy number for us. 45 or so is more kind of typical over the long term, so that's a very solid number. And that's what it looks like. But you don't see the housing boom because it's off the tail end of this table. It's before 2007, which is essentially when the recession hit. And so you would see 100 units or more just off the end of that table. So we're kind of starting to climb back up there. But like I say, again, it's a really good thing. And we feel that busy downstairs, so it's refreshing to see it because it feels like that. This is the map that's on the back of your packet or the back of your handout, and it shows the construction spread around the city. These are not just housing units, but these are housing and commercial, multifamily, single-family, commercial. And there's a variety of things happening. The new high school, of course, being by far the biggest project. Although we have a lot of investment happening out on Semiahmoo-Spit at the Semiahmoo-Shore project, where 30 or so units. Those are all single-family permits, even though they're duplexes. It's just a nuance in the permitting because that way they're allowed to finalize one unit without the other one being finalized and sell it that way. But there's a lot of activity happening in a variety of places. New High School, as I mentioned, is by far the largest, $29 million in construction value permitted there in 2016. And again, as you probably have heard me say before, this is a multi-year project, so there will be some other ones coming along, although this is the most expensive permit construction value-wise. So what does that look like? If we think about it in value then, 2014, our construction values were around $8 million. In 2015, our construction values were around $13 million. And this year, we're at $50 million, almost $51 million. It's a big increase. Because of the high school, it's driven more towards the non-residential side. So as you can see, 60% non-residential. We would, unless we have a big project like that happening, and even something as big as what was talked about with the boat storage with Sundance Yacht, Sundance Yacht might not be big enough to swing that over. We usually see residential as the bigger half, if you will. We are over budget by more than double in permit fees, so this is a good kind of being over budget. We anticipated or projected $140,000 in building permit fees, and we've taken in $369,000. And again, I would just point out that that does not include things like general facility fees, traffic impact fees. Those are other fees. Those are not building permit or plan review fees. So this is general fund revenue. The miscellaneous permits are still staying sort of high. But they're not as high as they were in 2015 and in some of the other years. One of the reasons for that, and you'll probably see it continue to decline if the housing starts continue to rise, is because it's hard to get contractors to come to your house and do things when they have lots of other work. They would much rather go work for the contractor that's building all those units out on Semiahmoo-Spit than come to your house and put a furnace in, because you only need one furnace. They need 68 furnaces. So it's typical that we see the when the housing starts go up, the other permits start to dive a little bit. You probably all have seen this. The second largest commercial construction project is substantially less at about $500,000. And that is the dentist's office just to the north of us here, about a block north. And almost finished. They'll be pretty, I think they'll be probably occupying that place within a month or so. It's, I think it's worked out pretty well.
They've already started
moving in. Have they? Yeah.
They've already started.
I think they'll be filling cavities there pretty soon. And this is, this is an interesting project to look at because this meets essentially all of our development standards with some very minor variation, but yet it's fairly modern. And when the owner, the dentist, was working with his contractor, he said, "I don't want to build an old-looking building." It's very common. We hear that a lot. "I don't want to build an old-looking building. We want to build something newer, nicer, more modern." But yet this still meets our design standards, and I think it fits in pretty well, all in all. It has the awnings, the big windows, and a kind of an interesting look to it. And it's probably a decent place to have a relatively short building because it kind of grades up into downtown rather than if you came across that bridge and there were a four-story building there, you'd be like, whoa, that's really large. Building inspections are, as you can imagine, high because of all the development activity. In last year, we did 621 building inspections. In 2016, last year, I mean 2015. In 2016, we did 874, so a pretty substantial increase. That will likely continue to rise if the numbers continue to rise. And we do have a lot of indications that those numbers will rise. We never really know until they walk in with the applications and then pick them up and pay for their permits. But we've had a lot of meetings for projects, getting some other long, sort of dusty old projects kind of moving forward, things like Carnoustie and others.
Michael?
Yes, ma'am?
Question. If there's 72 billion permits, how can there be 800-some inspections?
Because there are inspections for footing
multiple
drains and footing inspection and stem wall inspection and framing inspection and sheetrock inspection, and so there's
for each
a whole,
trade,
every
there's
single thing gets inspected all along the way.
And we don't always do all of those ourselves, right?
We do. Everyone except for fire sprinkler inspections, fire system inspections, those are done.
Do you do electrical?
Oh, thank you. And we don't do electrical. The L&I, Labor and Industries, does electrical. And we use a third-party contractor for fire sprint systems, fire alarm systems. So the vast majority of the 874 inspections there were done by Cliff.
Mm-hmm.
Probably, maybe 750 of them were Cliff, and the other or so were done by Tim.
Is Ed still working part-time, or is he
no,
completely gone?
No, Ed doesn't
gone?
Work for the city. He's been retired since March.
March.
So he probably did do a couple of those.
Okay.
He was doing very few inspections at the end. He was making sure Cliff was fully up to speed for all of those. But anyway, that's why there's so many. Land use permitting is also way over budget, again, in the good way. We anticipated about $10,000, and we collected $30,000. Excuse me. That's really hard to judge because we never know when somebody's going to come in with a big project. A lot of that was related to sea smoke. If sea smoke didn't come in, we might not have even hit budget. But it just happens like that. We have a couple of other plats that are, well, we have one plat that's in now, and we have a couple of others that people are talking about, so we may see the same kind of thing this year. Here's some residential construction. This is out at Clubhouse Point, a 4,600-square-foot home with a construction value of $591. I think that's the highest construction value. It's interesting, and Mr. Greeno asked me about this one time not too long ago, why is the construction value so low? Because there's no way I'm going to be able to build my house for that price. And these don't take into account things like your $400 kitchen faucets and your granite countertops and your hardwood floors. This is just the base construction value that we charge on, not your actual construction cost. So the reality is that's probably more expensive than that. Land use permitting. So we had 42 total land use applications that came in 2016. Most of those, the vast majority of them, were administrative. That means they were handled at a staff level, so they didn't go to Planning Commission. They didn't come to City Council. So of all of those 42, three of them came to you in 2016. Eight went to the Planning Commission, including your three, probably. And and then the others were handled by staff. That's a big increase, as you can see, from the prior years. In addition to those 31 that we handled at a staff level, there were 49 more that we don't really consider land use permits, like SEPA determinations, home occupation permits, land disturbance permits, which is a grading permit. So there's a lot of other things that are being processed in addition to those. So I would like to take the opportunity to remind you you may only see me here or Alex or Maddie here a couple times a year presenting a project. There's a lot of other stuff happening for that to bubble up to the surface. Those land use permits are pretty well scattered around, some out in Semiahmoo, as you can see, but the majority of them on this side of Lane, where there's just more property and more development activity generally. And I think it will continue to look kind of a lot like that. We only actually have a few large parcels left in Semiahmoo for development activity. It'll either start to push across the street onto the other side of the parkway, or there won't be much land left soon. And that, Mike. That was really pretty much the end. I'm not sure why the computer stopped moving. It's got a little timer there. But any case, any questions on the development report? Okay, we'll keep letting people bring in applications.
I do have one. Of the 72 applications for permits, how many are actually on the ground?
Of the 72, I don't actually know.
Or would you guess? Do you have any guesses?
Started on the ground,
yes,
as opposed to finished on the ground, I would say probably 60, 65.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, it's okay. Most of them. There are some that are pulled late in the year, right, and they're not really started yet. Mm-hmm. So the one thing that I would really, really like to show you here that's not coming up. I will bring back, because I'm pretty sure you want to know, and I'm not sure what's happening with the computer, but it's the enforcement activity. And it's a report related to how many things have been closed cases, and information related to hearing examiner hearings and how those have gone. So I'm thinking we're stuck, but let me try one more time.
I'm getting feedback.
We're stuck. I'll bring that report back as a separate item, the 2016 enforcement report. The good news is the hearing examiner has supported us in all instances on everything that we've brought forward, but yet the very large, vast majority of projects never went to the hearing examiner, and a lot of things have been cleaned up. But we'll bring that information back when the computer's cooperating. Thanks.
Michael, do you expect to get any permit applications from the development on D Street, D and 16th?
Yes, this year.
This year.
Yeah, we think that they will probably be paving early in the paving season, and that would be April, maybe. Depends on the weather when the paving companies open,
okay.
And that will be one of the last things that he probably needs to do out there.
Okay, good.
If he has his way, it'll be in March.
Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah. And then they'll come for final plat, which is Raven reviews the infrastructure. We review the other elements, bring that back to you for final plat. Then they can start building homes. They can actually build one before they plat it because they have a lot out there already. The whole thing counts as one.
Yeah. There's plans for how many?
30? 18.
Oh, only 18?
18.
Okay. Are they going to come in for permits for all 18 at once?
I doubt it.
Or?
No, it's a relatively small company. Mr. Imperio's company is relatively small. They'll probably build 3, 4, maybe 5 at the most at once.
Mm-hmm.
There's some economies of scale by building multiple units at the same time,
yeah.
But at a certain point, it's just too big for a small company.
Yeah. Okay, good.
But he does intend to build them himself, his company. So I suspect that what you'll see is that builds out over the course of like 2 or 3 years. And we'll also be building other things elsewhere because there's just he doesn't have enough capacity to absorb the city's growth.
Yeah.
Michael, does he have two on 16th Street?
They're a part of the same project, but yeah, two of them face 16th, and the rest are internal.
But those two could go ahead without the paving and the
Yeah, potentially they may be ones that he does earlier. I'm not exactly sure because I think he had to do street frontage improvements there, so he probably has some paving. But he could only do one because he hasn't cut it into multiple parcels yet.
Public safety, Chief.
Just a quick report on a couple of items, Your Honor. Council folks, incidents and staffing, we'll cover incidents first, just to let you know. So far, through today, we've had 496 incidents, which is about 5% higher than our five-year average. Out of those, we have 8 drug cases of one form or another, 6 misdemeanor assaults, a felony assault. No burglaries report quite recently, which is usually helpful for us and better than our curve at this time last year. We have 10 mental health incidents, which we've handled over the last 6 weeks. Refresh your memory, in Washington State, police officers are the folks who do the enforcement by taking into custody folks who are clear and present danger to themselves and or others and affect their transportation to hospital. And that is a growing trend in all communities, not just in Blaine, but each one of those can involve hours upon hours of an officer's time and effectively takes that sometimes 2 units off the road. And it's an issue that we're continuing to address because it's a countywide issue, but it is an area of concern for us because of the limited abilities that each one of our rural communities have to take care of those problems within the community. It always involves transport outside the city to hospital, and sometimes takes the officer off the road for a lengthy period of time. In terms of staffing, I'm happy to report that we have all of our officers now back into full duty status. We have no light duty officers currently, which is this is the first month in the last 12 months when I've been able to say that. And we are actively engaged in looking at health and wellness improvements we can make for our department and for the officers to help prevent the loss in direct and indirect costs, which amounts to many, many, many tens of thousands of dollars over the course of a year. When we have injuries like that, there are some cost-effective solutions, which we're actively and will continue to be working on. I can report back on later. We've had an excellent support by our community in terms of weathering the storms of the last couple of weeks. We had very few reportable accidents. We had very few non-reportable accidents. People did an awesome job of staying on the streets and or staying at home. Within the police department ourselves, we got one bent wheel rim out of it, and that was unfortunate. But I'm glad it worked out well. And kudos to Public Works for working so well with us on helping to keep the streets, keeping the traction that we had available for those days. We have had, you've probably noticed in the news, a couple of demonstrations at the Peace Arch border crossing over the last 3 weeks. The one which was slated for February 6th, which was going to be a no wall, no ban demonstration, which was put together by folks on the north of the border. Was delayed. I'm not quite sure if it was more for the snow or more because it was the big bowl game weekend, but for whatever reason, they put it off until just yesterday, and it went off again without a hitch. We had excellent cooperation from BC Medical Services, the RCMP, Canadian Border Services, and all the agencies that we rely on to help us in terms of keeping the traffic ways open and keeping keeping both the public and the attendees safe in those events. We are in the process of working with emergency management on both the Canadian side and the U.S. side to update some of our planning surrounding those events. They are technically very involved. Each one of them, as minimum, involves 16 separate agencies at the federal, state, and local level in the U.S. and in Canada. The meeting we had for the one on at the end of January, we had 50 officials from 18 different agencies in attendance at the planning meeting a couple of days before that event went off. It's very easy for those things to go south and for people to either get hurt or get seriously inconvenienced. And so we work really hard to do everything we can to make sure that doesn't happen and that our risks are reasonably managed. But I have to tell you, it eats up a lot of time planning for those. And I would not be surprised to see the number of those types of events increasing as time goes on. Any questions I can answer for council?
How's the guy doing up by the border?
I'm sorry, sir?
How's the guy doing up by the border, about the speeding along whatever?
Oh,
we haven't seen any emails, so it must be better.
We'll continue to call it a work in progress. I think the metrics, again, with Public Works help, we've had repeated contacts with the employers to the north of that residence and have gotten great cooperation. The metrics indicate that the actual rate of violation on that street are at or below the averages for violations on residential streets in Blaine. And we do everything we can to keep everybody happy.
Just a question for you. What is the local police department's involvement with an ICE activity? Do we get involved in that? Or
immigration and criminal enforcement?
Yeah. That's an issue in the paper.
Is that backdoor into the Sanctuary Cities question?
No, not necessarily. No, I just was wondering.
Okay.
If ICE were to attempt to find someone and take them into confinement, do our police department get involved in that at all? I mean, do they call upon us to take any activity at all?
When we get involved with working with any of the federal agencies, or state or local for that matter, and ICE in particular, it's usually in regards to public safety / officer safety ramifications of a particular action or interdiction. Are in Whatcom County and in our community, ICE is one of the federal agencies that is very, very well represented, and they normally have sufficient staffing to take care of any needs which they have. And anytime they think there might be an impact upon us, or a way in which we can help protect the safety of the general public, they will call and let us know. Otherwise, we are here to support and protect our community. We don't have a lot of contact with the ICE agents. They've got their own job to do, and they do it very well.
Okay. Another subject: our famous stop signs. East Portal, and we have one gentleman who is concerned about that, about people rolling stops, etc., on that thing. Are we planning to bring that up before the council at any?
He has
recommended that we remove the stop signs, and I don't know whether the council wishes to take that up as an issue or not. I know it's been brought up, and I just was wondering if you were ever going to...
With your continuing permission, I will be presenting a report at our next council meeting, I believe on the 27th, in specific regards to that intersection and in regards to the concerns voiced by the one person who has voiced concerns. about it, and we're happy to take a look at that. I tell you, just in way of preparation for the report, the background which we have so far indicates that the decision to place those signs was appropriately made. The benefit of those signs has been documented, and my most recent conversation was on Friday with our local representative of the Washington State Traffic Safety Commission, who is knowledgeable about those signs and their location and wholeheartedly supports them, and said they're a definite advantage.
Absolutely.
Now, am I right in assuming that that's a state highway?
That is correct.
Or state road?
That is correct.
And do we recommend to the state that stop signs be put up, or does the state?
I would defer to Ms. Whitewolf on that particular topic. My understanding is that we can make recommendations to the Department of Transportation about signage and traffic control changes on the state routes, but we cannot affect any changes without their approval.
Could they do anything on their own? Could they decide to put more stop signs up if they wanted to? I mean, how does that happen?
Because they are a state agency and this is a state highway, they're not interested in putting up more stop signs. I could say
But if they wanted to, could they do it without notifying?
Could they? Maybe, but I don't think they would. I mean, we have a very cooperative relationship. We're talking to them at least monthly.
But the decision's theirs, but they look for us to provide some support and input.
Correct. And my understanding is, you know, the whole arrangement with Peace Portal was something that, even with the angle parking and all of that, was done very collaboratively.
No, if I were to decide to take up the cause of stop signs on a state highway, who would I direct my comments to?
Wait.
Do I direct them to the city, or do I take them up with the state highway?
It's funny. I think as a city public works director, I would rather people funnel stuff through me so that I'm keeping that collaborative relationship. But if people are not satisfied with my response or with our speed of response, we could certainly provide them some context at the state.
And get just for my own information purposes. No.
It would be their Burlington office.
Do you just file those off with the state, or do you? I mean, every time anybody complains, do you take that complaint and send it off to the state, or do we try to answer it ourselves?
Well, and I think we do, to a certain extent, try to answer things ourselves because they're our citizens. These people are, some of them live as, you know, far away as Seattle, and they're driving up to Burlington to go to work, and what do they know about Blaine, right? So we try to have that personal relationship with our citizens.
No,
if they're not satisfied with our response, we're happy to forward them to WashDOT.
So do they know we're getting complaints? I mean,
we're getting continued complaint by one party, and I'd be super shocked if he hasn't contacted the state right now.
My response, I would anticipate, would be, don't call me, call the state. It's their Pullman Highway. I was wondering if that individual that is making this an issue has taken it up with the state and what their response is.
I'll be happy to double check with him and make sure he knows he has that resource, and even help him find the specific person at the state to talk to if he's not already.
Yeah, if he's writing off to the state, it would be interesting to know what they're saying to him.
Chuck here.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
I think you should call our state senator.
Yes, call your state senators in Washington. Mr. City Managers, you're on.
Sure.
And Adam.
I'm 8:45, so I'll kind of make it short here. I do need to talk to you for a few moments about collective bargaining after this.
Okay.
Just a few moments. Mr. Zell was in the audience tonight. He has asked the city to support him in an effort to document newspapers and other articles. He's taking up a volunteer effort to digitize anything and everything he can locate. So he's asked for city council support for that. I think he wants to use that to help him access newspapers and articles and those kinds of things. So that's going to be coming to you next meeting. Just want to give you a heads up about that. Ms. Janian has more information about that.
Is Jim going to be here to present?
Yeah, and he was here tonight, too. He just happened to leave early.
Yeah, so, I told him he should come and at the audience participation and just put forth what he and whether he wants it in the form of a letter or a resolution.
Yeah, it could be simply a matter of a letter signed by the mayor. So yeah, we'll bring something to you next meeting.
Yeah.
The Economic Development Committee, we're going to have some new members recommended to the council at the next meeting. We've got some turnover. We've got some new interested citizens who I think are going to be really terrific. We're moving forward with the Strategic Economic Initiative. You're going to hear more about that at the next meeting, and we're looking forward to that report. I'm going to be leaving tomorrow afternoon to go to Olympia. I did have a meeting set up with Senator Erickson, but I got called and canceled. Imagine that. But I do have meetings with Van Weerden and with Buys. And lastly, I just want to just talk about our service awards. You know, we've got many really great employees that work for us, and many of them have many years of experience, including our police chief with the city. So I'll give you the names of these folks and the years of service. We're also going to meet with employees. I've already delivered their acknowledgement, their checks they received, but I just wanted to read it into the record. So Clark Young has been with us now for 1 year as a public works employee. Jim Bird, 5 years. He got a $35 check. Mike Strader's been with the city for 15 years, and that policy gives him $125. Raylene King has been with us for 15 years, and actually longer than that. She started as a volunteer back in 1995. So she's been with us more than 20 years.
Harry, here's your chance.
$125. Wayne White, police department, 25 years of service for $225. And our police chief has been here 40 years. And the way the policy is written is it goes up to 30 years and the next one's a retirement pin. So we're going to have to do something special for our chief. We'll work on that for our next meeting and
he never
make sure he gets
me.
Recognized for that service.
He never caught me.
So that's a long service, chief. Amazing that you've done that. All right, and that's the end of my report. Any questions? One last thing, just for the audience, I guess, too, is we're starting to get nibbles on the airport property. And so I haven't got anything firm from a realtor, but we were told something was submitted today, and I meet with them tomorrow. And Michael's been working with folks as well, and he's got some tours tomorrow. So that's good news. Mm-hmm. End of my report. So I need about 10 minutes with you when this is all done.
I'm just going to do council reports, and rather than go at individual, I'm just asking.
Breakfast on Saturday.
Breakfast on Saturday, okay.
Yeah, I got something.
Okay.
I want to tell Sam. Sam put me for the library. I took over the library from Dennis. So, and on the chamber, they had a business workshop that 25 people attended. They want to try to have these meetings quarterly. They covered quite a lot of things, including the Main Street program, possibility of starting that. And also, they have submitted to WashDOT requests for quite a bit of signage, both on the freeway and around the circles, roundabouts. And I think you all got the email that had these attachments, so you can see what kind of signs they're requesting. And also, remember the Bite of Blaine. A lot of fun if you've never been to that event on February 20th, Monday night, at Semiamu at 6 o'clock, I think it is. And I think it's $25 a ticket, I believe.
Tickets are available at
the Building Center, Pacific Building Center, and probably at the Visitor Center, too, I think.
So. If I remember correctly, they're not available at the door.
That's right.
Yes, so you've got to get them at the Pacific Building Center. They sell them right there at the check stand.
Paul, any from you? Or
any?
Okay, anybody else? Okay, hearing it, there's one thing I wanted to mention, and that is on the 16th, which is, I believe, Wednesday, there's going to be a cultural ceremony at the old sewer plant. That's what it's called. And Linda Zoe is arranging that. It's at 12 noon. Come about 15 to 20 minutes early. I told her that I would ask. I said I would come, and I told her that I would ask any of the other council members if they would like to attend. It's at 12 noon at the old sewer plant, and it's a cultural ceremony.
On the 16th.
On the 16th.
At noon. That's Thursday, right?
Thursday noon. I think it's Thursday.
How long
is it? Thursday. No, today's the 13th. 14th.
Thursday.
Yeah, Thursday. So Thursday, 12 noon, and I think it would be kind of nice if we could have a number of the council members there.
So just for clarification, this is a cultural event.
Yeah.
It's not a legal event.
No.
We'll have to finalize that as a legal document when Mr. Sitkin finalizes that with their attorney. My expectation that will come to you on the 22nd. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like dedicating that site now over to the mummy.
Yes, I think the ceremony is really more of a cultural experience. They're going to do a traditional thing that they do. I can't describe it any better than that. But it was similar to what Harry and I and the chief went to, I think, about a year ago or so.
And said, I would recommend you show up 15 to 30 minutes before. We'll be outside, so wear a rain jacket. So I think it would be really kind of interesting to attend that plan.
So how long do you?
It'll be an hour.
Oh, I would think maybe an hour. Okay, is there any other unfinished business? Any council new business? Then I would suggest that you're going to break for
collective bargaining.
Collective bargaining and
no action.
No action, and we're planning on doing that in here.
Yeah, everyone leaves. We'll do it in here.
Okay.
Let's go in there so Sam can.
Okay.
Thanks, Ann. Oh, buddy. Well, your phone didn't ring anyway.
No.